Hello and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Thursday, August 20th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. Iowa Medical Director was aware for weeks of COVID data flaw. Iowa's medical director said Thursday that she was aware of inaccuracies in the state's coronavirus data when her agency used it to release flawed calculations that helped guide decisions on school openings and enrollment this month. Dr. Caitlin Padotti, the state epidemiologist, said she became aware in late July of a problem in Iowa's disease surveillance reporting system that backdated thousands of new test results. Nonetheless, Governor Kim Reynolds on August 6th released 14-day county positivity rates on the state's coronavirus website that she said would help school officials and parents decide how to proceed with the school year. The state announced Wednesday that, because of the backdating problem, those positivity rates had been erroneous for two crucial weeks and made changes that revised them. For 79 counties, the changes reduced their positivity rates, some dramatically. For the other 20 counties, the rates increased on Wednesday by an average of less than 1%. Errors in the local rate caused the Fort Dodge District to announce a delay in the school start date and then abruptly reversed that decision this week when they were corrected. Others tracking the data say they're baffled by the dramatic changes and have lost trust in the tracking system's accuracy. Reynolds has said that schools with a 15% positivity rate, a threshold three times higher than recommended by many public health experts, can apply for a waiver to start the year online. Otherwise, districts must offer at least 50% in-person instruction. Parents are also using the rates to determine whether to enroll their children in online-only options that districts are providing. Padotti said that for anyone who has tested multiple times, their newest test result was recorded on the state's website as having occurred on the date of their first test. That means many new results were backdated to March, April, May, and June. The problem was widespread, as more than 100,000 people have been tested multiple times in Iowa since the start of the pandemic, Padotti said. Padotti did not explain why she knowingly allowed erroneous positivity rates to be released, but she framed this week's correction as a routine change to give the public better information. We have to be flexible and we want to incorporate new information and adjustments as we move along, she said. I know that it's not ideal when things continue to change. At a news conference, the governor said the changes to the rates were minimal and did not affect the total number of people who had tested positive, case investigations, or contact tracing. She blamed an antiquated state information technology system for the issue and said it underscored the need to spend money on upgrades. Reynolds acknowledged that the virus was spreading across the state, with deaths surpassing 1,000 this week, current hospitalizations increasing, and nursing home outbreaks on the rise. Reynolds said she learned about the data problem last week, but her administration did not acknowledge it until Wednesday, 2 days after the Associated Press reported on the backdated positive cases. That problem came to light only because an Iowa City nurse practitioner tracking the data on her own found discrepancies, got an Iowa Department of Public Health epidemiologist to acknowledge the system error in an email, and shared the correspondence with news outlets. Others who had been asking about apparent backdating, including Sarah Conrad Baranowski of the Times-Citizen newspaper in Iowa Falls, say they were either ignored or told only by public health spokeswoman Amy McCoy that the website was constantly updating with new information. Nonetheless, Reynolds claimed that her administration had been transparent with the pandemic data. Only one county is currently above the 15% threshold, and Reynolds said that by next week, most school districts will have returned for classroom instruction. The state announced Thursday that it was delivering 650,000 face masks, 110,000 face shields, and other personal protective equipment to school districts around the state for educators and students. Iowa City District Teachers Union sue governor over in-person education requirement. The Iowa City Public School District and a statewide public educators union is suing Governor Kim Reynolds' administration over a state requirement that schools conduct a majority of instruction in person during the upcoming school year amid the new coronavirus pandemic. The lawsuit was filed Wednesday in Johnson County. Citing a new law passed earlier this year, Reynolds' administration recently issued the requirement after some districts, including Iowa City's and the state's largest in Des Moines, announced their plans to start the 2020-2021 school year with all online instruction. The lawsuit will argue that the governor has exceeded her authority and that local school boards have the primary authority over their education plans, and that the governor's order violates her constitutional duty to protect the health and welfare of Iowa citizens. The COVID-19 pandemic has reinforced the critically important right and need of local authorities and locally elected officials, like school boards, to do what is right for their communities. Brady Schutt, an Iowa City teacher and president of the Iowa City Education Association, said Wednesday during an online news conference. Jay Hammond, general counsel for the Iowa State Education Association, said the group will ask the judge for a temporary injunction in order to halt enforcement of the administration's requirement while the matter is settled in court. Hammond said the group will argue that the ultimate authority to design educational plans during the pandemic lies with school boards, and that the governor has exceeded her authority in establishing a statewide minimum amount for in-person learning. The group also will argue the governor has violated her responsibility under the Iowa Constitution, which charges government with operating for the protection, security, and benefit of the people. Reynolds' administration has pointed to Senate File 2310, passed this spring after state lawmakers resumed their work following a pandemic-related break. One section of the bill reads that unless authorized by the governor, a school district shall not take action to provide instruction primarily through remote learning opportunities. Reynolds' administration has determined that means at least half of instruction must be completed in person. Hammond said the group will ask the court to define primarily in that clause. The governor has built a house of cards on one word, primarily, Hammond said. We're going to take that house of cards to a judge and see what a judge decides. The governor's office did not respond to a request for comment on Wednesday. Reynolds is expected to hold a regular news conference on Thursday in Des Moines. Capital Digest, Protecting Poll Workers, Iowa Census. A roundup of state government and capital news items of interest. Iowa Census response. Lieutenant Governor Adam Gregg, who guides Iowa's Complete Count Committee, is urging Iowans to finish strong in filling out the 2020 U.S. Census before the deadline for the latest population tabulations. Iowa stands in sixth place nationally in self-response via online, mail, or telephone to the decennial census at 69.1%. Minnesota is tops at 73.1%, followed by Wisconsin, Washington, Nebraska, Michigan, and Iowa. For a time, it appeared that Congress would push back the census data collection deadline because of the COVID-19 pandemic. But that didn't happen, and the deadline remains September 30th, with Congress to receive the final numbers by December 31st. Mandated by the Constitution, the decennial census is used to determine how many seats each state will get in the U.S. House of Representatives. Iowa is expected to retain its 4 congressional seats. The number also is used to apportion funding for numerous federal programs. In Iowa, that's about $9 billion in federal funds channeled through various programs, including food stamps and housing programs, according to state officials. During Wednesday's committee meeting, officials said census workers are in the midst of a door-knocking data collection effort that began August 9th. Poll worker protection. Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate said Wednesday state officials are distributing personal protective equipment and more than $2 million in funds to Iowa counties to use for the November 3rd general election. Included in the PPE distribution are face shields, masks, gloves, hand sanitizer, and social distancing markers for use at the polls on Election Day. Additionally, more than $2 million from the CARES Act will be made available to counties. Making sure Iowans can safely cast their ballot is vital. It is your choice whether you want to vote absentee or at the polls, Pate said in a statement. Polls will be open on November 3rd. We are providing the materials necessary to protect voters and poll workers and reduce the risk of spreading COVID-19. The CARES Act funds that will be distributed to each county include a base amount of $5,000, along with an additional $850 for each precinct, he said. The Iowa Secretary of State's office plans to mail all active registered voters an absentee ballot request form near the end of August. For more information about voting in Iowa, visit voterready.iowa.gov. Clarion woman killed in motorcycle crash. A crash between an SUV and a motorcycle Wednesday has left a Wright County woman dead. Authorities say Michelle Joanne Gambrill, 56, of Clarion, was killed when her 2009 Kymco motorcycle was struck by a 2000 GMC Envoy driven by 40-year-old Michael James Curtis, also of Clarion. Curtis was eastbound on Highway 3 in Clarion and collided with Gambrill, who was headed west, as he attempted to make a left-hand turn onto 10th Street Southeast, according to a press release from the Iowa State Patrol. Gambrill was separated from her motorcycle after connecting with the SUV and was dragged across the road until Curtis came to a stop. No injuries were reported for Curtis. The Wright County Sheriff's Office, Clarion Police Department, and Clarion EMS all assisted at the scene. For Joe Biden, it's been a long path to this moment. He'll lean on that journey in speech tonight. When Joe Biden steps to the podium Thursday night as the Democratic Party's presidential nominee, he will offer himself to a wounded, meandering nation as a balm and as a bridge. A 77-year-old steeped in the American political establishment for a half century, Biden cannot himself embody the kind of generational change that Presidents John F. Kennedy or Bill Clinton represented. Even with wide-ranging proposals for government action on health care, taxation, and the climate crisis, he will never be the face of a burgeoning progressive movement. As a white man, Biden cannot know personally the systemic racism now at the forefront of a national reckoning over centuries-old social and economic inequities. But the former vice president, six-term senator, and twice-failed presidential candidate draws plenty on lived experience. Two generations spent on each end of Pennsylvania Avenue, a record that mixes partisan street fighting with bipartisan deal-making and bonhomie, and a personal journey of middle-class mores, individual struggle, and family heartbreak. That is how he is presenting himself as the person to lead the country beyond the tumultuous tenure of President Donald Trump. "There's a great seriousness of purpose here," said Valerie Biden Owens, the candidate's younger sister and, until his current White House bid, perennial campaign manager. "We are in a time of struggle. We are in a time of grief," she continued, nodding to the novel coronavirus, its economic fallout, and the reckoning on race. "All of this has come together. My brother appreciates it. He can feel it." The electorate ultimately will decide whether Biden, in fact, offers a bridge back to a pre-Trump version of normal, a path forward to a more equitable society, or some combination. Voters' most immediate consideration, though, may be that he is not the incumbent. "Everything that Donald Trump is, my brother is the polar opposite. I don't have to make him bigger than he is," said Sister Val. "Joe's the right person at the right time for all the right reasons." Biden has used his convention to showcase what his campaign hopes will be a winning coalition. Primetime hours have been generously sprinkled with Republicans. A video highlighted Biden's friendship with the late Senator John McCain, the 2008 GOP presidential nominee. Former Ohio Governor John Kasich endorsed Biden and assured anti-Trump Republicans that he has no worries Biden might make a sharp left turn in office. Biden, though, spent recent months working with primary runner-up Bernie Sanders and other progressives, tweaking his policy slate leftward. Those moves reflect Biden's increasing emphasis on wide wealth and opportunity gaps he says have been laid bare by the pandemic's economic effects. Sanders repeated his support for Biden on Monday and emphasized Biden's agenda as he urged skeptical progressives to vote affirmatively for the Democratic nominee, not just against Trump. Younger Democrats to Biden's left, several who are non-white, who have helped fill out the program. It's a public projection of what Biden tells top Democrats privately and frank acknowledgement of his age. He wants to elevate a new generation, one that looks wholly different from the all-male, nearly all-white Senate Democratic caucus he joined in 1973. He underscored the point by selecting California Senator Kamala Harris as his running mate, making her the first Black woman to join a major party's national ticket. Biden sees no inherent conflicts in his wide net approach, arguing over nearly 16 months of campaigning that the country must relearn how to govern by some semblance of consensus, and that starts with bringing varied voices to the negotiating table. Part of Biden's ability to make seemingly disparate appeals is that his policy pitches remain secondary to the personal pitch, amplified during the convention, that he is a decent, compassionate man of faith, a practicing Roman Catholic. While he likes to project an Uncle Joe persona, he still flashes the short fuse that was more common decades ago. In Iowa, he told one climate activist to vote for somebody else. He challenged a man who questioned his age to a push-ups contest. Still, empathy more than anger has defined Biden's life as the vice president who buried an adult son stricken by cancer, the young widower and father who lost his first wife and infant daughter in a car accident, and the schoolboy mocked by classmates and a nun for a severe stutter. His sister points to that childhood crucible as seminal and newly applicable in Biden's campaign against Trump amid the backdrop of a changing electorate. When you are bullied, you have a choice to make, Biden Owens said. You can become a bully yourself and step on people who don't look like you or don't speak like you or whose value you don't even begin to understand. Or you can choose to realize we are in this together and develop empathy, which is what Joe did. He appeals to your better instincts. Biden's candidacy has met criticism since he launched his bid April 25th, 2019, but he heads into the final 75 days of the campaign unscathed by second-guessing. It's a truism there are no second acts in presidential politics. Biden is on his third. His first White House bid in 1988 flamed out over plagiarism allegations. On his second attempt 20 years later, he barely nudged 1% in Iowa and watched Barack Obama soar to the nomination. When Obama tapped Biden as his running mate, it looked like his career capstone. Biden has said he wouldn't have run this time if Trump weren't president, but he did, and he stood out immediately. In a primary presumed to be about Democrats' ideological rift between progressives and the center-left establishment, Biden took aim at Trump. Sure, Biden sided with the mainstream liberals and moderates on policy, but in his stem-winding, sometimes poorly focused speeches, he lamented that Trump was damaging the soul of the nation. He often referenced a 2018 book, How Democracies Die. None of his rivals, even with routine excoriations of the president, offered themselves quite so plainly as the antidote. Early on, it didn't work. Biden finished fourth in Iowa, fifth in New Hampshire, and was in danger of collapse. But South Carolina's Black voters, a constituency not significantly represented in the first two nominating states, stood by his candidacy and propelled him to the nomination. The critical moment came when an endorsement from House Majority Whip Jim Clyburn, the highest-ranking Black member of Congress and a towering figure in South Carolina. "I know Joe," Clyburn said in an emotional appeal, but more importantly, "Joe knows us." Biden took complete control of the nomination about the same time public health officials urged a national lockdown. So he spent much of the spring and summer in the same place where he recorded his launch video last spring, his home in Delaware. Yet even with Trump mocking him for hiding in his basement, Biden will conclude his convention with a discernible lead in national and most battleground state polls. Biden will accept the nomination Thursday night without the usual trappings, the boisterous arena, the balloons. He'll speak instead directly into the camera as a relative handful of aides, family, and media look on. "We don't look at this as a victory lap," Biden Owens said, recalling the celebration when he narrowly won his first Senate race before his 30th birthday. "We stormed the convention center in Delaware, in Dover, with high school marching bands. We burst onto the floor with the bands and the cheering. This year," she said, "the convention reflects the moment." Lisa Quigley, ARNP, joins Mercy One North Iowa staff. Advanced Registered Nurse Practitioner Lisa Quigley is joining the Mercy One Center for Diabetes, Endocrinology, Kidney, and Weight Loss. Quigley is from Fredericksburg and is a 2017 alumni of Chamberlain College of Nursing in Addison, Illinois. Quigley brings 14 years of experience as a registered nurse in acute emergency and geriatric care. According to a press release from Mercy One, Quigley became passionate about caring for others after having a near-death experience when she was young. She enjoys traveling, spending time with family, and reading in her free time. Quigley will work with Dr. Thangaraj and Dr. Honk in the Kidney Center. To learn more about Quigley, visit mercyone.org/NorthIowa/provider/Lisa-Quigley-ARNP-nephrology. And Quigley is spelled Quigley, and nephrology is spelled Nephrology. Cerro Gordo COVID-19 update. Additional death. FDA approves saliva test. A data snapshot for Wednesday, August 19th. 53,538 total lab-confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Iowa. 696 total lab-confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Cerro Gordo. 493 total recovered in Cerro Gordo. 203 total active cases in Cerro Gordo. 1,003 deaths in Iowa. 20 deaths in Cerro Gordo. 14,117 COVID-19 tests administered at the mobile testing unit. A status report of monitoring and testing of COVID-19 in Iowa, including county-level data, provided by the Iowa Department of Public Health, can be found at coronavirus.iowa.gov. FDA approves COVID-19 saliva test. On August 15th, the FDA issued an emergency use authorization, or EUA, to Yale School of Public Health for Saliva Direct. Saliva Direct is a new method of processing saliva samples when testing for COVID-19 infection that does not require any special swab or collection device. This is the fifth test that the FDA has authorized that uses saliva as a sample for testing. When comparing results, Saliva Direct matched nasopharyngeal swab and other saliva testing methods at an 88% to 94% rate, according to data cited by public health expert Andy Slavitt. Although this is very exciting and groundbreaking, what does it mean for our area? The good news is that Mercy One Des Moines partnered with Corteva Agriscience and received FDA approval in April 2020. According to Kathy Biggs, director of the lab at Mercy One North Iowa, the validated specimen type allows for a more convenient and patient-friendly collection. Since we've been offering it already here at Mercy One, we don't expect a change to our current testing procedure. Currently, Mercy One of North Iowa is offering the saliva direct to patients that match the criteria for that method of testing. For Mercy One testing information, please dial the Mercy One Family Health Line at 641-428-7777. For more information, visit fda.gov. Police: 3 people killed in traffic crash in Davenport. 3 people died after their vehicles collided and burst into flames early Thursday in Davenport, police said. The collision occurred when the driver of a car going north drove through a stop sign and struck an SUV driving east, police said. The vehicle slid into the ditch and started on fire, KWQC reported. 2 people in the SUV and the car's driver all died at the scene. No one else was in either vehicle. No names have been released, and the investigation into the crash continues. Fuel truck slams into Waterloo house after crash. A man sleeping inside a Waterloo home escaped injury early Thursday when a fuel tanker truck slammed into the house, authorities said. Part of a neighborhood was evacuated after the fuel truck hit the home. The truck driver was extricated from the truck and taken to a hospital, the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier reported. Officials at the scene said the truck driver apparently lost control after hitting a minivan and before hitting 2 parked SUVs in the home's driveway and then slamming into the house. Authorities said officers responded to a call at a nearby convenience store fuel facility involving the tanker truck moments before the house was hit. A person drove a semi-cab through a fence and crashed into trees, and when a Quickstar driver pulling a tanker with more than 7,000 gallons of diesel stopped to check on the crashed cab, the cab driver drove off in the tanker, authorities said. The investigation is continuing, and further details were not immediately available. Father of man killed at his son's funeral says the shooting was accidental, not murder. Jamie Shorter sobbed Wednesday as he held his cell phone and tried to talk about the horror he saw on the first day of August. He tried to explain how Jeremy Shorter was killed at the funeral of Jeremy's 8-year-old son. And another family member said, "There is too much fake news about the killing. I had to help bury my 8-year-old grandbaby. That's a horrible thing to begin with," Jamie said. "Now I'm making plans to bury his father, my own son, tomorrow. I don't know how we are going to get through this. I don't know how we are going to do this. But I do have one thing to say. The world is wrong. The world is wrong about what happened, and the world is wrong about my son, Jeremy." On the morning of Saturday, August 1st, the Shorter family gathered at Wirt's funeral home on Jersey Ridge Road in Davenport for the funeral of Jeremier Leon Shorter. According to Jamie, the boy battled cancer his entire 8-year life. Jeremier was born May 15, 2012, to Kylia Crawford and Jeremy Shorter in Davenport, according to his obituary. At roughly 11:30 a.m., Scott County Emergency Communications Center started receiving 911 calls about a disturbance at the funeral home. When Davenport police officers and first responders arrived, they found Jeremy with gunshot wounds. Police later said the suspect, Numani Laster, 24, was captured after a car chase. He faces charges of first-degree murder, felon in possession of a firearm, eluding, and interference with official acts with a weapon. Jamie tried to explain what happened that Saturday morning. "Numani and my son are not kin," Jamie said. "Some people have been saying that. Numani had a child with the sister of one of the mothers of one of my son's children. Numani did not come to that funeral to kill my son. He got into an argument with someone else, and my son had to come out of the funeral home to speak with him. Jamie said he saw Laster had a gun and tried to grab him. I grabbed Numani, and that gun went off. Numani did not intend to kill my son. One shot hit my son and killed him. There's a lot of rumors going around about how and why my son was killed. I know the truth. I was there." Jamie said Laster's children were at Jeremier's funeral. "It's a horror what those children experienced that day," Jamie said. "No one wins from this. Everyone loses. I lost a son. Numani's people are going to lose him. Lives lost for nothing, for what was really a mistake." Jamie said he struggled with how to tell the story of what he says happened that Saturday morning. Willie Shorter, who identified himself as Jeremy's cousin, said he plans to attend Wednesday's regular meeting of the Davenport City Council. "I'm going to speak about what the media did to my cousin after he was shot," Willie said. "My cousin was disrespected, killed at a funeral, and then he was disrespected by the Davenport police and the media by running stuff about Jeremy's past record." Willie was not clear about which media published or broadcast information about Jeremy's past record. The Quad City Times did not publish anything about Jeremy's record in any stories about his killing. "People online talking about how it is all right my cousin got shot, because if you live by the gun, you die by the gun. That's fake news. That's a fake story. I don't care about how people feel about my cousin. I'm going to tell the straight story," Willie said. Willie also called Jeremy's shooting an accident. Laster is slated to be arraigned September 10th after 7th District Court Judge Mark R. Lawson granted a continuance Wednesday. In court documents, the county attorney has not offered any reason for why Laster was at the funeral home August 1st or why Jeremy was shot. Willie said rumors and fake news will cause more violence. "Innocent people are spreading blood out here because of all the fake news," Willie said. "Not everyone up on that hill is a criminal, and people are mad that victims are called criminals and their killings are justified. I'm going to City Hall tonight, Wednesday, to say it loud. When it's black-on-black crime, the Davenport police don't care. They will make the victim into a criminal." Willie said, "There's going to be a war over this if people don't stop telling false stories about what happened. The young ones are mad. They are mad at the media, Willie said. They are mad at what they hear. I can't stop them from retaliating. Nobody wants to hear this was an accident. For Jamie, the story of his son's death is hard to explain to people who just make assumptions. My son was trying to bury his own son, Jamie said. You don't think there can ever be anything sadder than that. And this thing happened. Nobody was there to kill anybody. I'm on this phone talking to you, and we are making plans for another funeral. This can't go on. It's all a horrible mistake. You are listening to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Thursday, August 20th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Helen G. Wilhelm, 1930-2020. Helen G. Wilhelm, 90, of Belmond, died Sunday, August 16th, with her children at her side at the Iowa Specialty Hospital, Belmond. The family will host an opportunity to visit, reflect, and celebrate Helen's memory from 3 to 4 p.m. Sunday, August 23rd, in the Trinity Lutheran Church Fellowship Hall, 304 3rd Avenue Northeast in Belmond. There will be a private funeral service and burial beside her husband, Dennis, at the Norway Township Cemetery, followed by public fellowship opportunity. Those wishing to express their sympathies through a memorial in Helen's name may wish to consider Trinity Lutheran Church, the Belmond Ambulance, or send to the family, or make to the donor's choice. Helen Geraldine Jotten, the daughter of Harlan and Gladys Amason Jotten, was born March 6, 1930, at her parents' home in Wright County near Holmes. She was baptized and confirmed in the Lutheran faith. She attended country school and then graduated from Renwick High School. Helen participated in girls' basketball, kitten ball, and played saxophone. Following high school, she attended Iowa State Teachers College in Cedar Falls. Helen then taught in the Humboldt school system for a time. On August 22, 1950, she married Dennis Wilhelm. Their union was blessed with a daughter, Pam, and son, Greg. Helen continued to teach school following the couple's marriage until Dennis returned from the military service. Upon Dennis's return to civilian life, he and Helen settled on a farm near Belmond, where they raised their children, and on the farm they truly were a team. In addition to being a loving, nurturing, and devoted wife and mother, she was very active in all aspects of the farming operations alongside Dennis, raising livestock and running machinery. Helen made sure that her children were active in church. She was always very supportive of their various activities and endeavors. She and Dennis always believed it was important for them to experience all that life in the greater world had to offer. Pam and Greg reflect fondly on their annual family vacations and the wonderful memories they created. Many of the trips would include extended family and close friends. Helen was a member of Trinity Lutheran Church since 1953 and was involved in Ladies' Circle, helped with funeral luncheons, and other activities. She was a longtime member of Progress Club, Kensington Club, the Belmond Hospital Auxiliary Senior Cards, and Bingo. She was an excellent baker and was known for her delicious mouth-watering kringla and other treats. She loved her flowers and enjoyed watching sports. Dennis passed away in 1997, and Helen continued to live on the farm for 6 years before moving to her current home in Belmond. In her years of widowhood, Helen looked forward to senior bus trips, dining out, and other outings with her many friends. She relished the role of being a grandmother and great-grandmother. She looked forward to following and keeping up on the lives of her children and grandchildren, and always looked forward to a time of visiting. She truly was a lady whose life focus was on the foundation of faith, family, and friends. Helen was preceded in death by her parents, husband Dennis, and infant daughter Paula, and her sister Marvell Lester. Her memory will be cherished by her surviving daughter, Pam Hellig, and spouse David of Beatrice, Nebraska, and her son, Greg Wilhelm, and partner Deanne Crafton in Goodell. Her grandchildren, Dan Hellig and spouse Ashley of Eagle, Nebraska, and their son, William, and Jason Hellig and partner Sarah Rinney of Philly, Nebraska, and Alyssa Wilhelm and companion Kyle Peterson of West Des Moines, and Alyssa's son, Wilhelm Will Mayhew of Kansas City, Missouri. Kelly Wilhelm and spouse Alala, and their daughter Inara. of River Falls, Wisconsin, and Joel Wilhelm of Goodall. Also surviving are many nieces, nephews, cousins, and friends, along with numerous members of Dennis's family. Charlene L. East, 1928 to 2020. Charlene L. East, 91, of Garner, passed away Tuesday, August 18th at Concord Care Center in Garner. A gravesite service will be held 10 a.m. Thursday, August 20th at St. Boniface Catholic Cemetery in Garner with Father Joseph Sevcik officiating. The service will be live-streamed on the Cataldo Funeral Home Facebook page. Social distancing guidelines will be followed. Memorials may be directed to the donor's choice. Charlene Louise East, the daughter of Alfred and Rose Dankbar Engstler, was born October 18th in Garner. She graduated from Garner High School in 1946. Charlene lived her entire life in Garner, where she raised her three children and worked as a home health aide. She enjoyed card playing, gardening, walking around Garner, spending time with her children and grandchildren, and making her favorite sour cream sugar cookies. She was a member of St. Boniface Catholic Church and Rosary Society. Charlene is survived by her three children, Jan Flatten and spouse Wayne of Terre Haute, Indiana, Pat East and spouse Larry of Waterloo, and Steve East and spouse Jody of Garner. Grandchildren, Kelsey Patel and spouse Chirag, Whitney Indukuri and spouse Dheeraj, Eric Flatten and spouse Christy, Jess East and spouse Molly, and Jay East and spouse Ashley. Six great-grandchildren, a sister, June Van Ort and spouse Homer of Garner, two brothers, Dwayne Engstler and spouse Mary Lou of Britt, and Russell Engstler and spouse Manita of Garner, a sister-in-law, Isla Peterson of Lake Mills, and many nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her parents and her brother, Ron Engstler. Rosella H. Ross. Rosella Hattie Ross of Esterville, formerly of Crystal Lake, passed away on August 18th at the Good Samaritan Society in Esterville at the age of 98. Arrangements are pending with Henry Olson Funeral Home in Esterville. Morris G. Callgarden, 1936 to 2020. Morris Jean Callgarden, 83, passed away Tuesday, August 18th at Oakwood Care Center in Clear Lake. A funeral will be held 1 p.m. Saturday, August 22nd at Elk Creek Lutheran Church, 4108 Kildare Avenue in Kensett. Burial will take place following the service at Elk Creek Cemetery. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, August 21st at Connor Colonial Chapel, 1008 First Avenue South in Northwood. Morris was born to Peter and Gina Holstead Callgarden at 3:33 p.m. Tuesday, September 29th, 1936, within the farmhouse in Brookfield Township. This was home for Morris for 66 years. Morris was baptized October 18th, 1936, and confirmed June 11th, 1950, in Elk Creek Evangelical Lutheran Church in Kensett. Morris began his education at Brookfield No. 8 Country Grade School from 1942 to 1950. He attended Kensett High School from 1950 to 1954, graduating in 1954 with honors. Morris entered the profession of farming, which he did from 1954 to 1970. His farming was curtailed at 1:33 p.m. November 16, 1970, by a farm accident resulting in the loss of his right hand and forearm. Morris continued his education, entering NIAC from 1971 to 1973 and earning an AA degree with the highest honors. On June 8, 1973, he attained the Certificate of Membership to the Alpha Chapter IACCVTI Honor Society. Morris continued his education by entering the University of Iowa, which he attended from 1973 to 1975, earning a Bachelor of Business Administration degree. He was a research officer for the General Assembly of the State of Iowa House of Representatives. Morris also was a Sunday school teacher from 1954 to 1970 and congregation president in 1983 and 1987. During the education period at the University of Iowa, Morris was afforded the opportunity to serve on the chief of the Ways and Means Committee, 1973. Morris was a lifelong member of Elk Creek Evangelical Lutheran Congregation and served as a choir member from 1952 until 2012, secretary from 1959 to 1970, treasurer in 2004 and 2005, deacon from 1993 to 1996, and on various other activities, committees, fund appeals, and projects. Morris was a member of Gideon International from 1999 to the present and was a speaker and presenter. Morris was a member of Kensett Lions Club from 1977 until the present, serving as president in 1982 and 1997, vice president, and other offices and committees. The Kensett Lions Club members honored Morris with Melvin Jones Fellow for Dedicated Humanitarian Services in 2009. Morris was elected Worth County Auditor in 1976 and served 24 years from 1977 to 2000. During this tenure, Morris served as president of Iowa State Auditors Association Region 2 from 1979 to 1986, president of Iowa State County Officers Association Region 2 from 1987 to 1989, president of Iowa Computer Users Borough Equipment from 1983 to 1993, during which county drainage program for computers was developed, and Iowa County's Drainage Committee Auditor Representative from 1977 to 2000. Morris had the distinction of never being defeated in an election contest. Morris served as King of Kensett Centennial and King of Beards in 1972 and served on the Kensett Quasqui Centennial Committee in 1997. Morris was married to Connie Joan Johnson at 3:33 p.m., April 26, 1980, at Elk Creek Evangelical Lutheran Church. Connie preceded him in death on June 4, 1999. Morris was a devout Lutheran. He was extremely proud of his Norwegian heritage and remained fairly fluent in the language. He was always eager for a passionate discussion on politics and news of the day. He was a huge Minnesota Twins, Vikings, and Iowa Hawkeye fan. He will be greatly missed by all that had the opportunity to hear a story from the past, discuss world or sporting events, and more importantly, hear his distinctive, boisterous laugh. Morris considered himself a recipient of extreme blessings from the triune Godhead by extended families, relatives, friends, and acquaintances, which were always precious. Morris is survived by his stepson, Terry, and spouse, Carolyn, stepdaughter, Kimberly Huinker, and spouse, Kevin, step-grandchildren, Kathleen Schweinfuss, and spouse, Cody, Kelsey and Kirsten Huinker, Jacqueline Ator, and spouse, Corey, Dean Johnson, step-great-grandchildren, Jasmine, Carly, and Jaleesa Ator, Cindy Kullenberg, Justin and Addison Johnson, Duke Schweinfuss, Riley Little, Kyler Hunker, sister Marlene Mattson, nephew Steve Mattson and spouse Anne, great-nieces Caitlin Elke and spouse Brendan and Callie Mattson, great-nephew Beckett Elke, nephew Scott Mattson and partner Leandro Cuna Bastos, nephew Daryl Mattson and spouse Tracy, and great-nephew Matthew Mattson and spouse Sarah, niece Darla Ritchie and spouse Perry. Morris was preceded in death by his parents and his wife Connie and step-grandchild James. Morris wishes to be remembered by memorials to Wycliffe Associates, Gideon International, or the American Bible Society. Globe Gazette 2020 All-Area Softball Team. The softball season is over and trophies have been handed out. In Iowa, we were lucky to even get the chance to have a summer sports season this year, and now that the season has come to an end, fans across the state can look back on this strange shortened season with fondness. After a spring of COVID-19 caused disappointment and heartbreak, North Iowa softball players took advantage of every moment they spent on the field. Several area teams made the trip to Fort Dodge, and while no area teams ended up winning state titles, they can be proud of their perseverance and success in this most bizarre year. The following list is the Globe Gazette's 2020 All-Area Softball Team, along with a Player and Coach of the Year. Madison Kelly, sophomore, Central Springs. Kelly, the Panthers' sophomore catcher, proved to be an invaluable player on offense. Kelly hit .552 on the season with a .682 on-base percentage and a .1052 slugging percentage with 8 homers and 26 RBIs. Awards received include the Class 2A All-State First Team, top of the Iowa East All-Conference First Team. Kalia Fessler, sophomore, Central Springs. Fessler was a valuable part of the Panthers state tournament squad with valuable contributions at the plate and in the pitcher's circle. As a pitcher, Fessler sported a .183 opponent batting average, but it was at the plate where she really shined. The sophomore finished with a team-high 28 RBIs with a .479 batting average, a .552 on-base percentage, and an .822 slugging mark with 5 homers. Awards received include Class 2A All-State First Team and Top of Iowa East All-Conference First Team. Cooper Clausen, freshman, Central Springs. Clausen had big shoes to fill this season after replacing Panthers great Hannah Ozenhus as the team's starting pitcher. But the Central Springs freshman proved that the team should be in good hands for the next several years. Clausen started 20 of the team's 21 games, posting a .213 opponent batting average, a .202 ERA, and a .117 whip, with 118 strikeouts and just 21 walks in 86.2 innings pitched. Awards include Top of Iowa East All-Conference First Team. Cameron Etherington, senior, Algona. Etherington was a spectacular force for the Bulldogs on both sides of the ball. At the plate, she hit .641, .767, and .1256 with 6 homers and 17 RBIs. As a pitcher, Etherington put up a .98 ERA in 99 innings of work with a .60 whip, a .124 opponent batting average, and 150 strikeouts compared to just 13 walks. Her awards include Class 3A All-State First Team and North Central All-Conference First Team. Paige Leninger, senior, Newman Catholic. Leninger was a major part of the Knights' success this season, with solid seasons as both a pitcher and a hitter. Leninger hit .449 and finished with a team-high 40 RBIs and 11 doubles. In the circle, Leninger held opposing hitters to a .239 batting average and finished 63 strikeouts, a .183 ERA, and a .135 whip in 114.2 innings pitched. Leninger finished as the program's career leader in doubles, RBIs, and batting average. Awards include Class 1A All-State First Team and Top of Iowa East All-Conference First Team. Lily Castle, senior, Newman Catholic. The Knights' left-handed shortstop finished her high school career with an outstanding season at the plate. Castle hit .439 for the year with a team-high .589 on-base percentage and a .667 slugging percentage with a team-high 22 walks. Castle set team records for single-season home runs, career triples, career hits, career runs, and career walks. Awards include Class 1A All-State First Team and Top of Iowa East All-Conference First Team. Haley Warman, senior, Newman Catholic. The Knights' senior catcher led the team with an impressive .522 batting average, along with a .550 on-base percentage and a .667 slugging percentage. Warman's 26 RBIs were second most on the team. In her career at Newman Catholic, Warman set team records for putouts by a catcher and is also the team's only first baseman to ever go an entire season without committing an error. Awards include Class 1A All-State First Team and Top of Iowa East All-Conference First Team. Haley Anderson, Jr., St. Ansgar. Anderson was the spark for the Saints on offense with a .435 batting average, a .500 on-base percentage, and a slugging percentage of .532. Anderson led the team with 27 hits, including 2 doubles and 2 triples. Anderson helped St. Ansgar to a 10-7 season that saw the team fall in the regional semifinals. Awards include Class 1A All-State Second Team and Top of Iowa East First Team. Leah Grimm, freshman, Osage. The Green Devils freshman had a spectacular breakout season at the plate this year. Of Grimm's 17 base hits this season, 12 of them were for extra bases. Grimm put up a .378 batting average, a .509 on-base percentage, and a .956 slugging mark with 6 homers and 16 RBIs. Awards include Class 2A All-State Third Team and Top of Iowa East Second Team. Sammy Miller, senior Mason City. The Mohawks senior shortstop finished up her high school career in grand fashion with a team-high 400 batting average, a .512 on-base percentage, and a slugging mark of .657. She also finished with a team-best 3 homers and 16 RBIs. Miller was the driving force behind a Mohawks team that made it to the regional championship game, which the team lost to Charles City 10-6. Awards include Class 4A All-State Third Team and CIML Iowa All-Conference First Team. Sarah Faber, senior, Clear Lake. As with every other sport she played, the Lions senior put up some impressive numbers this season. In 55 at-bats, Faber batted .451 with a .500 on-base percentage and a slugging mark of .618. She put up a team-high 14 RBIs, and her 25 hits were the second most on the squad. She was also successful on 12 of 13 stolen base attempts. Awards include Class 3A All-State Second Team and North Central All-Conference First Team. Julia Merfeld, senior, Clear Lake. Merfeld showed an impressive ability to hit for extra bases, finishing with 11 extra base hits on the year. She finished the season with a .452 average, a .469 on-base percentage, and a team-high .694 slugging percentage. Awards include North Central All-Conference First Team. Elizabeth Pfizer, senior, Charles City. Pfizer had a team-high 32 hits this season and proved to be a dangerous presence on the base paths, going a perfect 23-for-23 in stolen bases. Her 14 RBIs were the second most for the Comets. She also batted .464 with a .479 on-base percentage and a .580 slugging mark. Awards include Class 4A All-State First Team and Northeast Iowa All-Conference First Team. Ashlyn Heft, sophomore, Charles City. In the absence this season of power-hitting shortstop Rachel Chambers, Ashlyn Heft stepped up and provided the Comets with power. Of her 20 base hits, 9 of them were for extra bases, with 6 home runs and a team-high 20 RBIs. Her .759 slugging percentage was a team-high. Awards include Class 4A All-State Third Team and Northeast Iowa All-Conference First Team. Mackenzie Meister, senior, Bishop Garrigan. The Golden Bear senior was an RBI machine this year, finishing with a team-high 25 RBIs and 5 home runs, in addition to her .406 batting average, .472 on-base percentage, and a .719 slugging percentage. Awards include Class 1A All-State First Team and Top of Iowa West All-Conference First Team. Madison Meister, senior, Bishop Garrigan. The other Meister twin finished off her high school career with a spectacular performance in 2020. Meister led the team with 38 hits and hit .543, .570, and .814. Awards include the Class 1A All-State First Team and Top of Iowa West All-Conference First Team. Ann Horstman, Jr., West Hancock. With a .515 batting average, a .556 OBP, and a .697 slugging percentage, Horstman was a bright spot in a tough year for the Eagles. Horstman had 5 extra base hits for the Eagles with a team-high 14 RBIs. Awards include the Top of Iowa West All-Conference First Team. Kayla Carroll, senior, Rockford. In a bumpy year for the Warriors on the field, Carroll provided plenty of thump. The senior finished with a team-high 20 hits on the season with a .408 batting average, a .453 OBP, and a .571 slugging percentage. Awards include the Class 1A All-State Third Team and Top of Iowa East All-Conference First Team. Madison Maurer, freshman, Riceville. Maurer broke out in a big way for the Wildcats with a team-high 26 hits on the season, with a batting average of .448, an OBP of .508, and a slugging mark of .552. She was especially valuable on the bases, with 16 stolen bases in 17 attempts. Awards include the Class 1A All-State Third Team. Globe Gazette Player of the Year, Cameron Etherington, Algona. Coach of the Year, Belinda Nelson, Central Springs. After losing her top player, Hannah Ozenhus, to graduation this past season, Nelson's Central Springs team didn't seem to miss a beat. The Young Panthers team rode the arms of their lefty-righty pitcher combo and the strong bat of Madison Kelly to the program's 6th consecutive state tournament berth. With every starter slated to return, this team looks strong headed into 2021. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Thursday, August 20th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.
Some would call 88-year-old Sally Jackson a lucky senior.
A few years ago, a family member offered to move in and care for Sally so that she wouldn't have to leave the comfort of her own home.
But soon after, one of Sally's neighbors, Carol, paid a visit, unannounced.
Something wasn't quite right.
Sally's demeanor and physical appearance had changed.
Luckily, Carol was aware of warning signs that might signal elder abuse.
Such as bruises, poor hygiene,
isolation, depression,
appearing withdrawn or unusually quiet, as if to hide something.
When victimized, elderly people often feel ashamed, confused.
But an alert neighbor helped Sally.
Not all abused seniors are as lucky as Sally Jackson.
McGruff the Crime Dog here. The National Crime Prevention Council wants to help you and your loved ones prevent elder abuse. Know what to look for. Know how to report it to local law enforcement agencies.
To learn more, go to ncpc.org/seniors. That's ncpc.org/seniors. A message from the National Crime Prevention Council and the U.S. Department of Justice.